setting the folks on, glad that works. I've been told to speak up and speak more slowly. So I'll try and do that. I feel much trepidation because this is a strange subject for a Bible school. And yet I was asked to speak on it, and so here I am. Before starting, let's consider history as a whole. We know Yahweh intends filling the earth with his glory and having it known. We know that this is centered in his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, redeeming men and women so that they become like unto him. And we know that Yahweh sees the end from the beginning and that what he has decreed will come to pass. Nothing can stop it. Thus it is not fanciful to think that all that occurs on this globe finally links, however slightly, with that purpose. So thought about that way, the consideration of human history takes on a different light. And as we've seen in Daniel 4, verse 17, this is why we chose that particular reading. The Most High ruler in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will. Three examples of these things, three connected but little known examples. 7th of December 1941, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor. No warning, no declaration of war. Diplomats were to pass a note to Washington 30 minutes before the attack, but delays meant that it was presented after the attack. America was enraged and propelled against its will into World War II. 11th December 1941, Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. His Titanic struggled with Russia, not 6 months old. Was this sheer chance or coincidence? No. Angelic hands had worked, making General Marshall, the United States Army Chief of Staff, consider which of two enemies should get priority. Japan or Germany, both had to be fought, both had to be beaten, but which should be defeated first? He turned to Colonel Dwight D. Eisenhower, head of war plans at the Pentagon, and he'd served in the Far East, and initially he saw the Far East as being critical. But as MacArthur retreated in the Philippines, down to Bataan, and then to Corregidor Island, his view changed. He knew exactly what the first priority had to be, because he'd read a paper entitled The Victory Program, produced by, in July, 4 months before this attack took place, by his colleague, Lieutenant Colonel Alfred C. Wenimer, a professional soldier, a West Pointer, and a graduate of the German Staff College, class of 1936-38, and he knew what their strategic thinking was. So he urged that whoever controls the world island, Europe, Asia, Africa, look at the globe, you'll see that great landmass is surrounded by water. Whoever controls this holds the globe. Now Germany then held continental Europe, was moving east through Russia and also into North Africa. So he urged defeating Germany as a priority, despite the Japanese having attacked America. Several battleships destroyed and damaged others, many planes, killed 2,000 American servicemen, and many civilians. Despite that, Germany had to have the priority. And she received 85% of the United States war effort. In the light of God's purpose, why? First of all, goal, and not Germany, is to be master of the world, more or less, that's what we'll see. Secondly, Russia was to be saved from destruction so that she could lead the Gogian host. Thirdly, Russia had to triumph and become a major power upon the earth because of the Gogian connection. Fourthly, Germany was not to obliterate the Jews in Europe. She was to drive them back, or many of them, back to Israel. And finally, Britain and the United States had to win as allies to develop their role as the latter-day King of the South and the merchants of Tarshish. So in view of those requirements in the divine purpose, do you think it was chance or coincidence for Japan to attack America without warning, or Adolf Hitler to declare war upon the United States without need, or Albert Wenimer to be in the right place at the right time with the right advice? No. Angelic hands were busy. And we see that time and again throughout history. Oh, it comes on. No, it's disappeared. Oh, there it is. We turn that to Brother Thomas. You'll all have seen this photograph in the five page of Alpes Israel. The right on one of the small ones was when he was 55, 1862, during the time of the American Civil War. What do we find when we look at him? He went in 1832 at the age of 27 to New York as a ship surgeon, landing after what we might call an eventful voyage. His MD was an American degree obtained in 1848. The United States had then existed in its form barely 50 years. They signed a peace treaty with Britain in November 1782. That brought an end to the War of Independence. 13 original colonies. Along the eastern seaboard, and one or two just a little bit in, Maryland and Pennsylvania, a little bit in. They turned in 50 years to 24 states. Nine of the extra 11 were westwards. Two of them, Missouri and Louisiana, were actually west of the River Mississippi. The area more than doubled in size by 1832 and quadrupled its population, so that it was then 12.85 million. By 1861, nine further states had been added, mainly towards the Pacific Ocean, doubling the area again, and again increasing the population vastly, the area becoming 1.8 million square miles. Britain has 94,000 square miles, that's the comparison, and the population 33 million or thereabouts, 31.5 million, sorry. America was a melting pot, with many ideas bubbling, religious and otherwise, bubbling and tremendous energy being released. And Brother Thomas wasn't immune to this. He moved west from Richmond, Virginia in 1839. He then lived in Illinois, in Baltimore, in Philadelphia, in Kentucky, and moved back to Amelia in Virginia. And he visited Cincinnati in Ohio, New York and Buffalo. Very energetic and movable mind. Now, with that extension, 20 new states in about 73 years, and over 10 times population, a state of flux existed. Sectional tensions grew unbearable, and so war came. Not to end slavery, whatever populist conceptions opened, but initially to stop a group of states seceding, although, in fact, the urge to secession did indeed come from slavery. Using Negro slaves who work in southern states provoked intense feelings for long years. Many saw that slavery made the words in the Declaration of Independence ring hollow. Those words are these: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." They were originally from Thomas Jefferson. "So they freed their slaves because of that. Others eased their consciences by providing for the slaves to be freed upon their deaths. So they kept the benefits of the slaves whilst they lived, and they felt virtuous about what they had set in motion." Jeremiah speaks of that, doesn't he? In his 17th chapter. "Their heart," verse 9, "their heart is deceitful above all things, and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" So men could deceive themselves, but they can't deceive God. Now, the friction over slavery raged for years. In the north, and to begin the south, there were abolitionist societies formed who were out to abolish slavery come what may, whatever the financial end of the cost might be. In the south, there were southern fanatics who aimed to create a separate southern nation from the Atlantic to the Pacific where slavery could flourish. And they also had in mind that they might annex Cuba, Brazil, Mexico, I think, and the West Indies. They were not realist in any way. But the views were irreconcilable. Heated conflict took place, not only verbal. There was warfare on a small scale in Kansas, with each side pushing armed men to fight each other, and also in Missouri. A man named John Brown, you've heard of him, John Brown's body, he was an actual living man. He seized the federal arsenal in Harper's Ferry, Virginia, in 1859, hoping to foment a slight insurrection, a nightmare with white Southerners. A young or youngish congressman went into the Senate and attacked a northern senator who was in his 60s with a heavy cane, beat him senseless and caused grave injuries which he really didn't recover from. Fist fights occurred, men went armed with pistols and bowie knives into the Senate, into the Congress and so on. These events were in the late 1850s. Feelings became inflamed. But most people just wanted to get on with their lives. And yet, the propaganda from the press and the pulpit and the politicians had a toxic effect. And the poison spread and emotions rose to fever pitch. In November 1860, Abraham Lincoln, that's his memorial there, was elected to become the president. And that was the last straw for the Southern fanatics. Lincoln opposed slavery and was determined to stop its spread. New lands were then being opened up to the West, but he wasn't going to have slavery abolished. That was a very important factor which nobody recognized. And beyond that, he expected it to wither away because it was uneconomic, and he was willing to spend billions of federal funds to compensate those slave owners who freed their slaves. But these views were ignored by the Southern zealots, who just wanted to break away, and they seized that opportunity. Barely 6 weeks after his election, the convention was called by the South Carolina legislature on the 20th of December 1860. And that passed an ordinance dissolving the union now subsisting between South Carolina and other states. In January 1861, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, and Mississippi followed suit. And Texas followed on the 1st of February 1861. Later that month, these seven states formed the Confederate States of America. And they chose, let us put a capital on, so we're leaving behind, that was going behind them. They chose that word Confederate deliberately, that was a Confederate White House in Richmond, to emphasize that they were reaffirming the position of the original 13 colonies after the War of Independence from Britain, which they felt had been distorted by politicians in the years afterwards. America was in turmoil. Many Unionists echoed Major General Winfield Scott, Army Chief of Staff at the time, who was a Virginian, who said, "Wayward sisters, depart in peace." But Lincoln believed the Constitution did not allow secession. Others disagreed, but that was his view. That he had not been elected to preside over the dissolution of the Union, and he would not permit a peaceful dissolution. Some in the North welcomed war, urging that only by shedding blood could the nation's sins about slavery be purged. John Brown had been hanged by this time. Nevertheless, his favourite scripture had been Hebrews 9 verse 22. Without the shedding of blood can be no remission. And others held that same view. And equally, Southern firebrands felt that war would solve their problems. And they claimed that one Southerner was worth 10 Yankees. But war actually came when Confederate batteries fired on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, still held by the Union, one of the few places in the lower South which the Union still controlled. There was a Kentucky major in command who was sympathetic to the South, who came from a slave state, who had owned all slaves himself, but who remained true to his duties as a Union officer and refused to surrender. Major Robert Anderson. He had 84 men in his garrison, and his number two was a Virginian, Lieutenant Meade, who also felt sympathy with the South, but also did his duty. He wouldn't hand over peace prayers he was required to by the South. So the guns fired at 4:30 a.m. on the 12th of April 1861, and the war began. And of course, you might imagine, firing upon the flag, outrage ran through the North, just as it did in 1941 after Pearl Harbor. Lincoln called for 75,000 militiamen to put down an insurrection, as he expressed it, too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. And the response was overwhelming. Well, that call had another less desirable effect, as far as the North was concerned. It pushed Virginia and Tennessee and North Carolina and Arkansas to secede from the Union in sympathy with their sister states. And with that second set of secessions, the Confederacy gained much power, manpower, wealth, industrial capacity and so on, and military leaders of great ability. Men like Robert E. Lee, Thomas Jonathan Jackson, a Scottish Presbyterian by birth, Stonewall Jackson, J.E.B. Jeb Stuart, A.B. Hill, Joe Johnson, they were all Virginians, D.H. Hill of North Carolina, and Nathan Bedford Forrest of Tennessee. Now, all but Forrest were, or had been, regular soldiers and were graduates of West Point. Forrest was barely literate, having had little formal education, and he became family head before he was 16 when his father died. A self-made man, a millionaire, by his own efforts in slave trading, and then in running a plantation using the same slaves. Men who, having been treated humanely by him, suggested he bought land and they'd work it for him. He raised a cavalry unit, and because he did that, he became a colonel, he paid for it, and he called it his Critter Company. And because of this, and its natural ability and inquiring mind, he rose to become a lieutenant general with considerable success. If you read of his raids and campaigns, it's to recall Napoleon's activities, and he had no knowledge of that particular commander. Moreover, he helped many who had served under him, and used much of his fortune to help them. A courageous man, a vigorous man, 6'2", 13 stone, he was lean, with a courteous view of women, come from his mother and from his wife. Officers who didn't share that view didn't, were rejected, whatever their skill might be. After the war, he approached a priest who used the parable of the man who built his house upon the sand as his text, and said to him, "I am that man. I built my house on the sand." Despite the enormous efforts and devotion and courage and endurance of the rebel armies, largely matched by the Union troops, nevertheless, the result was a foregone conclusion. 11 states seceded, 22 stayed in the Union. The North had 22.4 million people, the South 9.1 million, of whom 3¾ were Negro slaves. In the military age group, 18 to 45, the North had 4.1 million men, the South less than a million. All the advances in national terms were with the North. But the South movement wanted to be left alone. She didn't want to conquer anybody, so she had that on her side. But nevertheless, it took 4 long, hard years for the South to subdue, which she did, the North to subdue the North, to subdue the South. And when the war was over, slavery had gone, finished forever, and the nature of the Union had changed permanently. No longer was it possible to see it as a compact between sovereign states. It was now a nation. The cost in blood was terrible. 624,000 soldiers died during the conflict. 121,000 actually killed in action. The rest died of wounds or disease, as prisoners of war, from accident, were shot for desertion, or hanged for other offences. And beyond that number, 500,000 survived battle wounds. Some 3.25 million men served in the forces. Just do the figures. You'll see that almost 1 in 5 of those who marched off to the war, very often gleefully, didn't return home. This war equaled the deaths in all the other wars involving the United States from the War of Independence of 1770s right the way through until partway through Vietnam. Their total deaths in those other wars were 636,000. So it's only 12,000 in a 4-year war and wars over 200 other years. And many of those who returned home had their health undermined by suffering from wounds, disease or hardships. They died permanently. Amongst those were Robert E. Lee and Bedford Forrest, both of whom died early after prolonged ill health. And many civilians lost their lives. Crops, or property were destroyed by battle, by accident, or deliberately. The Shenandoah Valley was razed to the ground, and so was much of Georgia, by the Union Army to deny sustenance to the Confederates. It was costly in blood, it was costly in treasure. $6.19 billion for the North and $4 billion for the South, and costly in human suffering. And those feeling that the nation's sins regarding slavery could only be expiated in blood, often other men's blood, were amply satisfied. Now that's a bare outline of the Civil War. We emphasize it was a time of terrible turmoil. Brother actually set against brother, and father against son, and families divided, and close friends severed in that same way. We might see some detail of it later. But we now remark that it was in this troubled time that Brother Thomas lived, in Hoboken, New Jersey, to where he'd moved some time before, and with other brethren and sisters. He was caught up in this upheaval. Now, some would have suffered in one way or another. We'll draw some conclusions later on the line we mentioned. How do these things stick God's purpose? Well, let's just see how our brethren and sisters fared in these anxious days, and particularly John Thomas. It has been said, unfairly, that John Thomas sympathised with the South and condoned slavery. His remarks on his travels in the First World Year indicate that the rebel troops with whom he came into contact were of a more pleasing disposition than the Unionists, whom he described in his typical blunt way as the offscourings of the cities. But it is more significant that he saw all that was happening as under the divine hand, and he felt no urge to advocate the freeing of slaves or the resistance of invasion, because it had no relevance to what really mattered, preparing for the coming of the great king. He regarded the United States in a particular way. He saw it as like the land of Shinar in its ambitions and policy of its builders. In the Herald of the Kingdom, January 1861, as the crisis was coming to its fruition, he had this to say after remarking upon what happened at Babel several thousand years before. Human nature is the same in this age and country that it was in the land of Shinar 4,000 years ago. Its ambitions and impieties, its hypocrisies and abominations are as heaven-defiant and intense as ever. For as Paul says, in the flesh dwelleth no good, and in this there has been no change since he wrote the words. And he follows these words with a mighty blast that the men in authority in the north. No doubt he held similar views of those in charge in the South. His final remarks indicate that he found that the conflict which would probably follow in January 1861 would lead to the time of trouble of Daniel 12. Well, he was wrong in that, in the complete sense, but it may have been a forerunner. Now, John Thomas had lived in America for some 28 years, and although he'd spent some time in Britain in 1848, 1850, and Europe as well, he travelled widely in America, lived in various places, and he preached wherever he was, in those and other places also. Because of this, in his extensive writings, groups of believers in the truth had grown in different towns and cities. In 1851, this is staggering, brothers and sisters, to me. In 1851, he's just returned from Britain and Europe, and he obtains the use of the Hall of Delegates in the Virginia state capital, Richmond. That was where he was living at the time. This information I got from Brother John Rampton, I'm indebted to him. He wanted to give three addresses on biblical prophecy. The first one, Nebuchadnezzar's image of the empire now rising in the old world and the destiny of the kingdoms of Europe. The second one, Gog and Magog, or the image empire proved to be Russian, whose autocrat will be the emperor of Germany. And the final one, the unclean spirits like frogs, or Austria, the Pope and French powers in relation to the present and the future. These are powerful things to think about, brothers and sisters, and he was doing this long, long ago. Now, giving those addresses meant that his beliefs would become more widely known to those men in or near power, and they would recognize they had an unusual medical practitioner in their midst. So by the time the war came, there were believers in many parts of the United States, from New York in the northeast to Louisiana in the east and west to California and many places between. I've got to be careful of relaxing myself to some sort of finality. There were brothers and sisters in the vicinity of the war. Virginia itself was a war zone for all the 4 years the war lasted. Many states were untouched by the war, at least directly. But Kansas had suffered considerable lawlessness for some years before, as had Missouri. And in those states, there were believers, as in Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, through all of which the armies marched and fought, and ships as well, up the Great Rivers. And we'd love to know how our brethren fared in these dangerous and tumultuous times. There were believers in Baltimore, Maryland, where the doctor lived at one time. Still in the Union, but a slave state. It surrounds virtually Washington, the national capital, on three sides. A third of its people lived in Baltimore, only 36 miles from Washington. So it was important to Lincoln for Union troops to travel south to defend Washington from rebels nearby. Thus they came to Baltimore. They detrained at the East Side Station to march through the city to entrain for the capital. There had been no direct line. On the 19th of April, 1861, a week after Fort Sumter, the 6th Massachusetts Regiment detrained and entered Baltimore to march through. They were impeded by a mob, Confederate in sympathy. The rioters attacked the rear companies with bricks and paving stones and pistols. Now these men had not been in the army very long, ill-trained, frightened, and they opened fire. The mob erupted and the troops had to fight their way to reach the station, in the course of which 4 soldiers were killed, as were 12 civilians, and scores more were wounded. Now we don't know that our brothers and sisters were involved in this, but they will be aware of it and they will be afraid. Believers also lived in Virginia, some in Richmond, not far from the war area. And others lived in Norfolk, on the coast. And Harvey and I know we were in Virginia some years ago, the same week that the ecclesia at Norfolk came across from the unamended to the Central Fellowship. So there were believers there 150 years ago, or thereabouts. They lived under 2 sets of military control, although there wasn't much fighting in the air, so I believe. Another group lived in King William County, between the Pamunkey. I don't think I can bring this up. That's all, in case you didn't know. I'm happy. On the steps of the Museum of the Confederacy. They lived, some lived in King William County between 2 rivers, the Pamunkey and the Mattapony. Marvellous names in America. Those rivers joined to form the York River and flow into Chesapeake Bay. Not much military action there. But a 7-day battle took place in the area, and that would only be about 10 miles from King William County. So our brothers and sisters would, although not directly affected, they'd hear the artillery rumble, and they would suffer the loss of crops and fences and livestock from foragers, by theft or encroachment and so on. Virginia as a whole suffered for much of the 4 years by having 200,000 men at times rampaging around the country, and Lee had trouble feeding his army. Now, our co-believers may not have been much affected directly by the fighting, but they would have suffered in other ways, as we suggested. And they'd always known that the tide of battle could easily come their way with the real peril that that would bring. When Union troops took southern areas, they were suspicious of locals because of guerrilla activities and so on. When southern troops took the area, they were suspicious of those who didn't support them. So any southerners like our brother and sister who didn't support the South will be regarded with suspicion by their neighbours. On one occasion, Brother Thomas was called an abolitionist after replying to a question about brethren bearing arms or serving if drafted. And he said that it was not right for Christian civilians to turn into soldiers. He based that remark on Paul's statement that believers should remain in the calling in which they were called. And he went on. Non-Christians, that's a terrible point, isn't it? Non-Christians were alone to themselves. And if drafted, they could serve. But those under law to Christ should not, and according to the law of the land, need not go to the war. And he ended by stating, let Satan do his own fighting. There is no obligation resting on the saints to lend a hand to help him in distress. He was said to be preaching abolition. and he was urged he should be arrested. And that was in September 1861, before the war really got going. What was urged against him would be held against those who followed him, who understood his teachings. They would have a difficult life, particularly when the casualty list began to rise. Now, war breeds widespread lawlessness and violence. We've seen that time and again, even in our own country's troops' actions. Looting was commonplace, and wanton destruction took place in southern parts occupied by Union troops. Justified at times by the statement, rebels have got no rights. We can assure, therefore, that any of our co-believers living in areas visited by Union troops or by Southern troops would have an unpleasant time, to say the least. The first major battle took place at Bull Run in Northern Virginia, known as Manassas in the South. But before that, Brother Thomas took the train from Jersey City, he was now living in West Hoboken, New Jersey, and publishing the Herald of the Kingdom from there. And he was going to see brothers and sisters in the areas affected by the war, or going to be affected. He went first, he was going to Illinois, Wisconsin, Kentucky and Virginia. He went first to Chicago. Now that's 730 miles west as the crow flies. And that was just a staging point. Having got there, he went a further 70 miles to a place called Freeport, and then he hired a buggy and did the final 12 miles to Brother Cochran's house. He was there for 5 days. He met many brothers and sisters, some of whom travelled as far as 90 miles in that, those conditions, to meet him and to talk to him. I keep forgetting to press my little book. That's Robert E. Lee there, distinguished man, wearing 3 stars, the rat badge of the colonel, although he was a general. He never wore a general's rat badge for some strange reason. Brother Thomas stayed at Brother Cosman's for 5 days, and then he went east again to a place called Rockford, moved up into Wisconsin. He was there for 3 days and met many brothers and sisters. And he commented that although the soil of Illinois and Wisconsin was rich, the society was rotten, and that the war was detrimental to the sale to the south of local produce. He then moved 280 miles south to Henderson, Kentucky, on the Ohio River, went by Indiana, arrived on the 3rd of July, 1861, not long before Bull Run, and he stayed there 13 days, exhorting and encouraging brethren and sisters. He found that 2 sisters had moved away from there into Arkansas, and another doctor, Dr. Foles, had been recently baptized. He'd opted to be away from home only about a month, but he found that he couldn't travel to Richmond as easily as he expected. But he was determined to go there. He'd lived there, he had brothers and sisters there, and he knew that they would be under pressure from the people involved in the war. They were seeking to draw them in. He wanted to encourage them. So he left Henderson and sailed up the Green River. He went some 240 miles in a steamer, and then by rail to Knoxville, another 195 miles. And from Knoxville he went to Bristol, a further 180 miles. And there he stayed overnight. And then he travelled on to Richmond, another 100 miles. So since leaving Henderson, he travelled 700 miles, going by steamer, one night on a steamer, another in a hotel in Bristol. He knew that hotel, so he didn't hang about. When the train stopped, he was off like a shot, got to the hotel early, got a room to himself, within front of sharing a bed with the Confederates then. And he spent a fortnight on the train to Lynchburg, comfortably seated, for a 12-hour journey, 180 miles, an average speed of 15 miles an hour. Now, he was a fine, upstanding gentleman, professional man, but he was no shrinking violent, as the means he used to get a seat on the train to Lynchburg shows. Having slept and eaten at the best hotel in Bristol because he knew what was what, he went to the station next morning and found it full of troops moving up from Georgia to Virginia. He saw a captain, accompanied by his wife. And she was armed with a bowie knife and a pistol. He describes her as being of middle stature, young and good looking, but with the armlets about her waist, she reminded him of Boadicea, or of an Amazon, rather than that fabled angelic sylph whose name is Woman. He noted the hour approaching to get on the train, and he foresaw a great rush of bodies, civilian and military, seeking the board. The carriages were there, unattached to an engine, but all locked. A quick reconnaissance showed him that, whilst the doors were locked, the glass in one had long since disappeared, leaving a hole 2 foot square. So an intrepid brother put his valise through the hole, put his head and shoulders through, his hands on the valise, and head crashed over his head. An older man observed this and decided that he couldn't do that neat feat, but he'd asked Brother Thomas, would he take his carpet bag and reserve a seat for him? And Brother Thomas looked at him and realised he was an intelligent and polished heathen, and therefore he had a better journey with him as a companion than with others. So they travelled together. Brisbane was reached on the 24th of July, just after Bull Run, and after encouraging the believers there, he then decided it's time to go home. He went to see Brother Alan Magruder, a lawyer, a Virginian, who had fled Washington because his brother was the rebel general, John D. Magruder. And there's Rebel John D. Magruder, known in the old army as Prince John because of his aristocratic ways. Brother Magruder provided a letter to John Thomas, to the general, his brother the general, seeking a pass for him to go between the lines. Now, Prince John had been with his brother before the war to listen to Brother Thomas talk on how Christ would establish the kingdom. He thought the views very rational and said he was satisfied that if Brother Thomas was right, then a strong military and naval force would be needed. And that he liked that idea because probably his services would be required as a military soldier. Before the journey homeward began, however, Brother Thomas went south to a place called Moonburg. Whilst preaching there, two police officers sought to arrest him under the Act Respecting Alien Enemies. Now, Brother, as I said, he wasn't a shrinking violent, and he was quick with his wits. He stated that he was an Englishman, and as such he was an alien friend, because England was not at war with the Confederacy. Unconvinced, they sought a lawyer, who confirmed that they had no grounds for arrest. And then he began taking leave of his friends, seeing several that were all friends from Campbellite days, one of whom had a son who served with General Magruder, and who took Brother Magruder's letter to the general. In a few days, the general responded. He would pass Brother Thomas across his lines with a flag of truce to the Union lines. His way to seeing the general was circular, but eventually arrived there. Having been ill with a severe cold and a fever, perhaps flu, before he arrived at Richmond and at General Magruder's headquarters. Magruder, having wined and dined him, and he was noted for having a good table, he sent in 8 miles with three officers as escort to a cavalry camp en route to General Butler, where he received great hospitality. In the camp, he said, of 650 men, plus Negro slaves, plus mosquitoes. An armchair was placed by a blazing fire with a table, on which was placed a whiskey bottle, water, sugar and glasses, and he was advised to make free with it to fortify the stomach against the cold night air. Recent ill health made that seem a good idea, so he sat sipping whiskey and smoking a cigar to keep away the mosquitoes, and he wrote that he had no fear of teetotalism or anti-tobaccoism, as he hoped that the whiskey and the tobacco would be beneficial. Supper was called, and well feasted on various local produce, he retired to the tent provided, sleeping on a board floor where several quilts and blankets had been spread, and he had a sound, refreshing sleep such as had eluded him for some years. In the morning, Negro servants attended him, bringing water and clean towels and soap and his newly black boots. And he took another glass of whiskey on the basis that what was good at night in the cold air was good in the morning in the cold air. And he breakfasted on fried ham and chicken and the usual fixings. Given a snack, and he went then to the Union lines under a square yard of white muslin on a 10-foot pole with an escort now including four troopers. And many Confederate soldiers gathered to see him off, which indicates how they regarded him. Delivered to a Union officer, his escort bade him farewell. And in response to our brother shaking hands with each of them, officers and men alike, and saying he hoped that he might meet them again, unharmed, in a happier time, they thanked him, stating that they would all be glad to hear of his welfare because they had spent a very pleasant time together. The bearing and conduct of the Union troops our brother saw didn't impress him at all. He said that if the Washingtonians are going to compel the Confederates and restore the Union, they must organize a different sort of army than that we saw in Ravelton. He didn't wrap his thoughts up, didn't Brother Thomas. He saw and heard of unseemly behaviour towards women, or some women, and he wrote that men need not be astonished at the determination of the South to resist this northern invasion of licentious barbarians to the bitter end, even to ruin and death. A northern captain said if the South did not quit within 90 days, then fire and sword would be carried through the land after the manner of the autocrat of Russia. Brother Thomas made a strong case in mind. He moved north, up into Washington, into Baltimore. He went to see his brother, found his brother was a surgeon in charge of the hospital. Spent some time with a brother Nichols, and he went to swing himself, stealing from that brother's 40-acre market garden by Union soldiers, a cost of about $200. Returned to Baltimore, gave a lecture in the Redman's Hall, exhorted the believers, and next day left for New York. Arriving home after being away almost 3 months and travelling over 2,300 miles, he had an eventful tour. He'd met and encouraged many believers, being threatened by arrest on one occasion by Southern policemen, and warned that one of the most dangerous of the Partisan Rangers, Captain Letter Colonel Morphy, would arrest him if he went to Louisa County in Virginia. That didn't happen. In many places, the thought most stirring the believers then was how they should react to the war. The general view in the South, shared by many of the border states, which were slave states, was that she had been invaded by the Northerners intent on her subjugation. And that view affected some believers who asked, were they not allowed to protect their own property? Some held slaves. His view was no. They can help the Second Williamson, but they were not to be involved in other ways. At the time of this first tour, Brother Thomas found that the pressure was only from friends and relatives to join the force and so on. In April 1862, the conscription law was passed in the South, followed in the following March in the North. The age was in the North, 18 to 35, had to serve for 3 years. In the North, 20 to 35. Substitutes allowed. You could pay for a substitute. The draftees or their families could pay someone to go instead. That gave rise to the claim that it was a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. Eventually substituted in stock. In August 1864, Brother Thomas was appealed to for help because young brethren in Illinois and in Kentucky faced being drafted into the Union and the Confederate armies respectively. So he went first to Kentucky. He met Brother Robert Stone, one who was subject to the draft. And he met also Brother Eads, who was a notary public, that's a legal office, and Brother Paul Blackwell, who was a magistrate. Strange things these in those days, brothers and sisters, who said that the Confederate law exempted ministers of the gospel from bearing arms. This particular draft was effected in 2 days, so speed was essential. A certificate was made for each one of the 10 affected, which Brother Thomas validated. And then, accompanied by Brother Stone, he went to speak to Colonel Napier, the local Confederate commander. He was introduced as from New York. The commander said, aren't you afraid of being in a Confederate area? No, he said. I've been here before with my friend General Magruder. That, of course, broke the ice. They discussed the reason why he was seeing them. Brother Thomas remarked about the exemption law. The colonel knew that. He then said, how many churches are involved? The reply was one. And how many ministers are paid? Well, none. But all the brethren are ministers of the gospel. That's a queer church, said the colonel. But he was convinced that it was acceptable, and he then gave us a certificate validating the exemptions, and he had them endorsed in his own name, and thus the 10 brethren were spared the draft. Something similar happened in the North, in Illinois, not quite the same, because there the federal law exempted those of a denomination conscientiously opposed to bearing arms, subject to paying £300 or finding a substitute, or serving in the hospitals. This provision excluded all but the Quakers, because all the regular denominations supported the war. So the result was a certificate prepared, certifying, amongst other things, that the associations or ecclesias of Christadelphians, the name was adopted then and then to avoid being called Thomasites, that they were conscientiously opposed to bearing arms or being involved in politics. The needs of the times were met, and this stance has served the Brotherhood for 140 years. Early on, we said that all history links to the divine purpose. Is that true in the Civil War? Well, there are two things I can only give to you in brief, which demonstrate the truth of that. When Robert E. Lee took over the army, the main army of the Confederacy in Virginia, Virginia was under siege from the Union Army. He drove them away, and he moved north into Maryland to feed his army, to take the war into the Union areas, and he was looking to aim the long to destroy the Long Bridge over the Susquehanna west of Harrisburg and control the means of moving from east to west for the Union. He was then going to go to Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, and cause all the trouble, and support the anti-war view then growing in the north. The Potomac was crossed. He had a large Union force at Harper's Ferry in his line of retreat and of supply. So he sent Stonewall Jackson with 2/3 of his army to suppress that, whilst he went north with the remaining third. Each general got carefully written instructions. But one general, General Hill, D.H. Hill, got two copies. One from his immediate commander and one from Lee. And one of his officers wrapped 3 cigars in them and carelessly left them behind when they moved on. A Union sergeant, looking for something worthwhile having, found the cigars. That's a good find, he brought. Put them in his pocket, casually looked at what they were wrapped in, saw what it was. He was whipped up to the Union General McClellan, who read it with an officer by his side who'd served with the man who'd written the orders. So McClellan knew exactly what was happening and how divided Lee's army was. The result was a battle, the Battle of Antietam. That was Bull Run, by the way. That's gone. That's Antietam. The white building is called the Dunker Church. The lane is called the Bloody Lane, which Harvey and I walked along. That was a lane in which a very fierce battle took place. That battle defeated Lee's intention of doing a lot of damage in the north, and he lost a lot of men and had to move south. Do you think it was accidental that the orders he'd written were found very quickly, within hours of being written, were taken to the commanding general, who had a man who could confirm that they were written by the man who was Lee's adjutant? No, that was not accidental. So Lee's attempt to move into the north was defeated. 9 months later, he tried again at the climatic Battle of Gettysburg. I think we've got one here. That's General Longstreet, his staff at Seminary, Gettysburg, where Harvey and I and Auger have been and looked at that. That's a picture of some troops, I'm not sure whose side they're on, thought to be preparing their supper at Gettysburg. And that is a view from Seminary Ridge where the Confederates gathered, looking across about a mile and a little slope then up to a ridge called Seminary Ridge. That was the climatic attack on the third day of that battle, which defeated Lee. And he had to retreat. He'd been let in that position by his cavalry commander, failing for once, Jeb Stuart, a young man, smarting from having been surprised at Brandy Station a week before, didn't do his job, concerned to regain his glory by riding right the way around the Union Army, and finding he couldn't do that. He had to struggle for 7 days to try and find his way through. And while he was doing that, Lee had no information. That wasn't coincidence. These things were happening because of angelic hands, because the South had to lose. If the Confederacy had won, then North America would have become fragmented like Europe, subject to internal conflicts. Such an America could not have rescued Britain in 2 world wars, could not have sustained the fledgling Israel, could not be involved as part of the Tarshish power, could not be able to play a part in the setting the scene for Ezekiel 38, which is now taking place in Iraq. That scene setting is continuing in Iraq. Thus it was the Union had to triumph despite Brother Thomas's dislike of their overwinning politicians and scruffy, ill-favoured soldiers. Gettysburg was the Confederate high water. Afterwards she slipped away until 2 years later she surrendered, Lee surrendered, at Appomattox in southern Virginia. That's the little round top at Gettysburg. You can tell them the technical, but not responsive press. I'm going on that.
Well, again, Joe.
Press, press again.
No, you're pressing the wrong one. It's the left one.
I'm pressing. That was left. Good enough, anyway. I was only going to show you a picture of the house, the McLean house, where we surrendered, and the slave quarters, which were behind that house, with all the sat in front of them. Lee was a great man. Many were great men in those days. Many were deeply religious men. Lincoln was one. His language echoed the authorized version. Lee and Jackson made their plans and saw the result as under the hand of God. So when the surrender came, he saw it as God's will. An anxious mother came to him and said, give her advice to guide her son in life. Madam, he said, teach him to deny himself. Just think of that, brothers and sisters. He wrote later, duty is the most sublime word in our language. No man can do more, no man should seek to do less. Those sentiments echo the way John Thomas lived his life. Once seized of the truth of God, he was indefatigable in the way he tried to live that truth and to publish to any who would listen what that truth was about. All else was suppressed. Wealth, status, comfort, fame, influence. Most or all of these could have been available to him because he was intelligent, diligent, energetic. But he saw his duty as proclaiming the gospel wherever he could. And he spent the bulk of his life doing just that. A life of denying himself to fulfill his duty to Yahweh, to proclaim his word. And by the grace of God, we are the beneficiaries of that devotion.